The hardest part, I think, about being the survivor of a suicide is that there is so much speculation. Why would this person who is so happy and so amazing and so special and so loved, why would he do this? There must be a reason. She must be the reason.
Welcome to the Express Soul Health and Wellness Podcast. In each episode, you'll learn from experts about the best practices and technologies to live a happier, healthier, and hopefully a longer life. Here is your host, Claudia Erdenola.
Welcome to Express All Health and Wellness Podcast. My name is Claudia Erdenola. I am a professional engineer with a passion for health and wellness. And here at my podcast, we discuss all related to wellness and better ways in how you and I can live longer, healthier, and happier life. Today, my guest is Rajani Ayusi. Rajani is a veteran from the Army. She served 9 years on the Army and went to 4 deployments to Afghanistan. She got on special operations and special forces, worked on intelligence during her deployments, and she had a story that you don't want to miss, and she will give you all the details of her experience on how is dealing for our veterans, for our veterans community, for many of them, that they left war, but war never left them. All of the horrors of war and how the struggles with PTSD, mental health issues, depression, and veteran suicide. Is something that today, this is a huge problem. And we, as a community, we want to help. And we want to be part of the solution. Rajani now is in civilian life. She is a therapist. And she is part of the solution as she's helping many to deal with the mental issues and recovery from addictions in our veterans community. So she's gonna tell us about that. And please stay tuned because the story is great. And I know after this podcast, you're gonna be very, very much informed about what to look for and how you can help as well to those veterans that are struggling with mental issues. So thank you very much for your support, and I hope you stay tuned with us. And remember, if you haven't subscribed yet, please subscribe right now to our channel and hit the notification button. We would love to have you as part of the fam. Also, leave us your comments below. We love to hear from you if you like this kind of content, and if there is some other content that you would like for us to bring guests and bring you more education about those here in our podcast. We will be happy to do that. Again, we love to be in touch with you guys. And if you leave us a 5-star review, that would be even better. Follow us in all our social media channels, Instagram, Facebook. We are also on TikTok. We'll see you there. Thank you. We're working with the American Legion on this campaign, Be The One, which is the program from the American Legion Be The One program to end veteran suicide. This is episode 102, Breaking Silence, the reality behind veteran suicide. Rajani, welcome to Express All Health and Wellness Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
So for all our audience, I would like to get back in time a little bit and let us know how a girl like you back in the days decided to join the military forces. What was your main drive, your decision making at that time to join the forces?
So that's really interesting because I didn't have any family in the military. And at the time I was actually dancing. So I was a contemporary dancer. I was very involved in dance, teaching dance. I was a makeup artist. I worked for MAC Cosmetics. So my lifestyle at the time was not anything indicative of what I would be doing in the future in the military. But I did have a dream one night. And in that dream, I got a timeline. And they said that in a certain amount of time that my life was going to change. And I had a friend in the military at the time, and I went to go visit. And I was watching like a playground from the room. And it was a time of day where, you know, everyone had to stop and salute the flag. And I remember I saw all these little kids get off the playground and go and pay respects to the flag. And I thought to myself, it was brief, but I thought to myself, man, I want to be a part of something like that. And then that actually happened before the dream. And then when I came home, I had this dream. Mm-hmm. And I just had this drawing to join the Army. And within a few days, I was in the military.
So how was the training then? And where?
I went to Fort Jackson. It's actually in South Carolina. The joke is it's called Relaxing Jackson because it's supposed to be one of the easier basic trainings. You know, military, Army people, we poke fun at each other. So I went to Fort Jackson. It wasn't like Benning, which is for infantry and it's all men. I had a good mix of male to females. It was different. It was something that I'd never experienced before. I thought that I was fit. I thought that I was in shape before joining the military. But I realized then that I wasn't a runner, and that was something that I was going to have to work really hard on. I had to learn humility because I'm used to being kind of very assertive. And now people were telling me what to do, and I didn't like that well. I didn't handle that very well. So it was, I would say it was more challenging mentally and emotionally than it was physically.
Incredible. So you were training, and when do they tell you, okay, you are going for a tour to Afghanistan? How was that training? Because I understand that you also trained to jump out of airplanes.
Yes, I did.
And yes, helicopters. And this is something, I mean, for a girl at that time, I just imagine you with all your gear doing this. Yeah. How was that training? And when did they tell you were going to Afghanistan?
So Afghanistan came, the way that it's set up, you have basic training, your mm-hmm. basic combat training, and that's like your first 9 weeks. And that's when you're really learning how to be a soldier. So all of the foundational things that you need in order to be a soldier, how to march, how to customs and courtesies, military bearing, your marksmanship, so how to fire your weapon, all of those things happen in basic training. And then after you graduate basic, you go on to your specialized training. So it's like your advanced individual training, AIT. And I was in AIT in Fort Huachuca, Arizona. So like the middle of nowhere, Arizona, in a place called Sierra Vista. And that's where our intelligence school was. And I was training to be an intelligence analyst. They actually had recruits come from Fort Benning for a program trying to get the men into the Ranger Regiment. So, you know, showing them how cool it was and then saying, hey, do you want to go through this particular training in order for you to be a part of regiment? Which was, you know, we say high speed. It was a really high speed opportunity. I didn't know anything about the military when I joined, so I didn't know enough to recognize that it was a male's game. And I think that I was just assertive enough and naive enough to really fight to try and be on this special team of people. And long story short, I got it, and then I went from Fort Huachuca. Before I had a duty station, then I went to Benning to train with the guys that I would be deploying with.
And that training was?
That training was interesting.
What do you mean by interesting?
Well, I was the only female there, so that was a challenge. So that was a challenge because I was doing something that people had really negative opinions about, especially in terms of safety. So there were a lot of, you know, you're going to be taken advantage of, you're going to be assaulted, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I did have nerves surrounding that, of course, but I was just excited. I was excited to be there, to have the opportunity to meet people that inspired me to be a better soldier. Because if you're in that area, if you're in the special operations community at that level, you're not there to party. You know, like you're there to do a job. Serious and the party job comes later. Exactly. So I think that I really grew as an individual just working with them and trying to keep up. You know, like you really have to push to try and keep up.
So that was the training. But does the training really prepare you for what you were going to face when you got there to Afghanistan?
In some aspects it does, right? I really knew how to do my job. I felt that way. You know, I felt confident that if I was given a task to mm-hmm. complete in Afghanistan, then I would be able to do it in terms of intelligence collection or turning the intelligence into actionable information. I did feel prepared for that. I did feel like I was safe. I really felt like I was with people that were able to keep me safe, and I had the skills to keep myself safe. But deployment is a visceral experience. It is something that happens and it engages all of your senses in a way that you can't really describe in the schoolhouse. You know, like you don't get that feeling when you're in canned scenarios. You know, you always know when you're in training, whether you're in the field or you're in a building, you always know there are left and right limits. And I would always say to myself, they're not going to kill me. Right? In training, like, I'm not going to die.
Exactly. And you were in mainland. But when you were there.
Yes. Yes.
Facing the elements.
Exactly.
Facing the people. You were prepared to do that.
Yeah.
How was the level of intensity? How was that? I just want my audience to get a sense of what was happening. How old were you?
When I was 23.
Very young.
When I first went to Afghanistan.
How was that, I would say, that emotional experience? What was the day-to-day?
It was, so I remember this very vividly. We touched down in Afghanistan, and it was pitch black. I mean, we got onto the tarmac, and it was pitch black. And I remember the first thing I remember was the smell and the feel of the air. Like, the air felt super dry and, like, gritty. And I thought, this is not Miami. I am not.
You're not in Kansas anymore.
I'm not in Kansas anymore. And it smells different. You can feel the heaviness of the country. Mm-hmm. But also the excitement. At that moment, I wasn't fearful. Mm-hmm. I was excited. I was like, I felt fired up. Like, I'm ready to do this. Let's go. You know, that's how I felt. And then you have a couple of experiences that come, and you start to see things, and you start to face the fragility of life and of your own psyche, of your own bearing, you know? And that's something that I think that maybe we're not prepared for, but how do you prepare for that?
Exactly.
It's just, you have to be there. You have to see it. You have to experience it. And until you do that, you really don't know what it's going to be like, because the movies don't really do a good job of explaining it. It's always quite theatrical and, you know,
sanitized version.
Yeah.
Of the real
thing. Yeah.
This
absolutely
is how I call it.
Yeah. Yeah, or a dramatized version of the real thing. And then it almost feels like if there aren't constant explosions or if there aren't constant firefights, then you're not engaging because you're not doing the job. And I think that it's the balance, because there are times where you are under attack all the time. And then there are times where there's nothing going on and you have time to work out 2 times a day, and you have, you know, mm-hmm. you go to the chow hall and you eat and you watch movies, and you need those times. You need the down times, because the tough times they're coming.
And they consume you.
They do. They consume you.
So where was, if you remember, and you can share that with us, of course, what was the first experience, the first one that you say, this experience during this time really started getting into my mind and my heart? It really was hard. It was like, you know, it's when that, you feel that pain. What happened?
I think that it was coming home. It wasn't there. It was
really,
yeah, it was coming home the first time, after my first deployment, and feeling like I'm not supposed to be there. So that being there always felt very natural to me. Really? It always felt very home-like. I don't know how to describe it, because when I was there, I wanted to come home. But when I came home, I wanted to be there.
Hmm.
So it was a constant tug of war with the rational part of my brain, like the logical, that part of your brain that says it makes sense for you to be stateside, because stateside is safe. But then when you are stateside, it doesn't make sense to be there, because there's so much that needs to get done back home. And you know that your friends are deploying and they're still going back, and you leave and you feel like things are unfinished. And so I think that that was that was the hard part for me, was having to come back and acclimate back into a routine that I found to be quite boring.
I guess you have a lot of activity over there.
Yeah.
Come back here, not feeling your feet anymore in what was your previous life.
Right. And what was my role? Because I deployed before I had a duty station. So I didn't really have a home. So my first experience with the military outside of training was deployment. And then I leave deployment and I come back and I'm junior enlisted, you know, I'm low ranking, and I already have a special operations deployment patch, and I'm going into this unit with people that, you know, didn't have that opportunity yet, and they'd been in the military a bit longer than I had. And, you know, there were speculation that I was maybe CID, which is like an internal spy, you know, like I was spying on them, you know, all of these kind of weird things. So trying to find my place, and I just wanted to be back with my guys. I just wanted to be back out there.
So you went for the first tour. Then how long it took you from the first one to go back to a second tour?
That's a good question. I have no idea. But it was pretty quick.
Okay.
It was pretty quick, yeah.
And then things start getting more intense then?
Yes. Yes. The second one,
happened, Rajani?
I think that one was more hostile than the first one. And so we were hearing a lot more about people who were not making it and who were dying, and, you know, like that part of it is always difficult. And I was already kind of used to my job at that point, so I was very comfortable in, like, filling the role and traveling. I would travel back and forth a lot. And I think I was exposed to more death on that deployment than I had been exposed to on my first deployment. Not that things didn't happen on my first deployment, but I don't know if I was more excited the first time, so it didn't feel so bad, you know? Yeah, it. I think for me, when you are in that situation, for me, it's like not the continuous worry for self, but the continuous worry for the people that you've grown to really care about. Because I was deploying again with the same people.
Group.
Yeah, so my unit, on my first deployment, I got the opportunity to have duty station of choice. And when I told the commander, he asked me what I wanted, and I said, I just want to be able to come back with you guys. So I was sent to a unit that had a detachment that would deploy in support of these same people. And so that's where I ended up, and it was great. I get all giddy thinking about it. But it was different this time because it felt more real. The first time felt maybe like a movie, like I was kind of in this surreal experience. I didn't really have a grasp on what was happening or what I was doing so much. But the second one, I knew exactly what I was going back to.
And when you say it felt more real and you were exposed to more death, I mean, how long it took your second tour? For how long you were there? For 1 year?
No. So in our community, we deployed between like 6 and 9 months at a time. So they were short deployments, but...
Got it.
But
that one was intense.
Yeah. I mean, we were there to do a very specific job.
Mm-hmm.
We were a capture kill unit. So it was a lot of like, we have to identify a target. We have to go out and get the target. And that's just the way that it was. It wasn't a lot of reconnaissance and, you know, like going and checking things out and winning hearts and minds, which is a part of the psychological operations unit. That's the unit that I was in. But this particular group of people, that really wasn't the focus as much as it was supporting the guys who were identifying these high-value targets and then trying to get them.
Do you think in doing this job during this time, you already went to the first deployment, now you are in the second, things are getting more intense, you start collecting this, like accumulating these emotions and your thoughts.
Yeah.
What happened then? You went to...
So Other deployments? Yeah, I did go to other deployments. But here's the thing. When you're in it, you don't always feel it. You don't always recognize it, right? Especially if the people that you're comparing yourself to are just as wild as you are. You know, like if the culture at the time, you deploy, you come back, and you party hard because you just survived this thing, right? Everyone's doing it. So you're kind of in a silo. Mm-hmm. I didn't ever feel like, wow, I'm so different. Mm-hmm. Then
you were with everybody
else.
Yeah,
everyone was doing it. The hard part is in the silence, in the quiet times, you know? So like it would come up maybe in my inability to sleep, or when I did sleep, I was thinking about things that I'd seen or experiences that I had, or wanting to go back. So like I would dream sometimes that I was there and wake up and feel disappointed that I wasn't, you know? And so that part of it, that the psychological, like, mind-bending aspect of it, you know, like, it kind of, it twists your perception of what you're supposed to be doing, right? I went through all of this training. I'm supposed to be deployed. I'm supposed to be whatever. That's the hard part. It's not for me, and we all have different experiences. Mm-hmm. We're all super unique in our experiences. So I'm not speaking for the military in general, right? But for me, the hard part wasn't being there. The hard part was not being that person that I was there at home. Right? And so you grow a thick skin, and I am a female, you know, uh-huh. and a female in the military and a female that was doing that job. And you start to see the world a little bit differently. And I think you start to conform a little bit differently or resist mm-hmm. Conformity. And it makes relationships hard. It makes being okay with the mundane aspects of life
yes.
difficult, right? Like we talk about now as a therapist, I talk about the simple pleasures. The intentionality that we put towards our everyday life mm-hmm. and enjoying the little things, right? But if you're used to operating at this level and your adrenaline is pumping and you're always going, go, it's intense. Mm-hmm. And then you come back and you're like, you want me to enjoy what? Like, what exactly am I supposed to be enjoying? I really struggled a lot with boredom. And I think that contributed to unhealthy relationships with alcohol, because I had a lot of fun when I was drinking and the adrenaline was high and risky behaviors and those kinds of things. And, you know, my friends and my husband at the time that we'll talk about
yes,
in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was the same and rode his motorcycle really fast and drove fast cars. And like, mm-hmm. we were always like pushing. Mm-hmm. And I was drawn to that. I didn't see it as unhealthy, though. I didn't recognize that then. That was just normal. That was the normal part of life, and I was okay with it.
Our podcast will continue in a short bit after this message. Dear friends, this is Be The One Coffee. We are in support of the American Legion Be The One program to end veteran suicide. And we created this product, Be The One Coffee, which is delicious coffee, freshly roasted, and shipped to you free of charge if you purchase more than $50. So remember, if you want to support Be The One and you want to taste the most delicious coffee on the market, try Be The One Coffee. You can order it with the following the QR code here or the link below. And remember, every time you purchase Be The One Coffee, you are part of the solution, because we are donating part of the sales to Be The One program. Be The One Coffee. We also have K-Cups for those who like K-Cups. And stay tuned, because we are releasing about 13 new flavors very soon.
And that I think I hear a lot from other veterans, that the real hard time is when it's quiet.
Yeah.
When they're silent, when they have to stay still,
mm-hmm.
they can't, they don't feel, mm-hmm. all the thoughts come. It's like the heart is pumping on
yeah.
as they remember the experiences. So you mentioned it, your first husband, when did you meet him?
I met him when I got to the unit. So this was in...
He was part of your unit?
Yes. So he was a part of the unit that I was sent to after my first deployment.
Got it.
He was there. And he was another soldier. His name is Chris. He was another soldier there. The life of the party. Everybody loved him. And we didn't date. He was actually married at that time. We didn't date or anything, but we had mutual friends. Like, all of us, we were like this little family. And we would eat together and hang out together, and it was really nice. And then after my second deployment, I'm trying to remember, like, exactly when, but after my second deployment, he ended up getting a divorce, and we got together, and it was a whirlwind romance. Super fast, you know? Like, we clicked, and that was it. And I remember one day he came up to me, and he said, "I'm going to marry you." And I was like, "No, you're not." I'm not interested. You know, I wasn't interested. I wasn't even considered. Like, that was a thought that was so far from my mind at the time. And it was, I loved his pursuit. You know, I loved his consistency because I was very, I'm not interested. And he spoke to a mutual friend of ours and was like, "Would you mind?" Because we were a close-knit group. He was like, "Would you mind if I dated Rajani?" And I was like, "Why are you asking for permission? You didn't even ask me." You know, like, who do you think you are? Anyway, he won because I ended up marrying him. And on my third deployment, I was about four months in, I think, at the time. Yeah, I was 4 months in. And I got the notification that he had completed suicide.
He was there.
He wasn't. He was in North Carolina at our home. Yeah. So we were already married, and I was in Afghanistan. Yes.
So he was in one of those quiet moments when it's silent, and he committed suicide.
Correct.
What was going on your mind then? What happened after?
It's like being picked up and thrown into a tornado. Life just immediately stops existing in a way that you knew. I knew that Chris was struggling. I did not know that suicide was an option. You know, I knew because we had gone through circumstances in our marriage. Like I would witness behaviors that I found to be very bizarre. Like him waking up in the middle of the night and loading a shotgun and going on patrol. And then one night he was having a nightmare and he banged his head on the nightstand. And the next morning I asked him about it and he had like a big knot on his head and he said he didn't know what happened. And I don't know, to this day, I don't know if he knew what happened or not, you know, but these were behaviors that really concerned me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand them. I had no understanding of mental illness at all. So I asked if, I told him we needed to do something because it was starting to scare me. And so I asked if we could go to marriage counseling because I thought, like, if I can get him into therapy, then maybe the therapist will see. And you know, I don't know. Like, this is way above my pay grade. And so we were in therapy and we were going consistently every week. And then the therapist said, "I would like to meet with Chris
alone.
And I felt immense relief, you know, like, finally. And so he was meeting with her for some time. And when I was in Afghanistan, he became what I would say now with the knowledge that I have. And this is super subjective, right? But he began to act almost manic, like what I would see from a client who's manic. And so he became very like suspicious and accusatory and hyper focused on things that just weren't in touch with reality. And I was in Afghanistan and I was like, I can't do my job and do this at the same time, like try and figure out what's happening with Chris. And so I remember one day we were on the phone and I said, "Chris, have you been going to your therapist?" And he was like, "No, I stopped." And it started to make sense. I was like, wow, because his behavior had been super bizarre. And I said, "Why did you stop?" And he was like, "Well, I didn't want to be a burden to her because her dad died or her mom died. Like, there was a death in the family, mm-hmm. and I guess she had to take some time." And I said, I don't think that's the way that it works. You know, I was like, that's her job. And to do this job, I imagine you have to love it. At the time, I was not interested in being a therapist. But he stopped and I said, well, can you please call her? Mm-hmm. I know her name. I don't want to say it on the podcast. But I was like, can you please call so-and-so? And I'm sure she'll want to see you, you know, because she wanted to work with you when I was there. And he told me that he would, and he didn't tell the truth, you know? I don't think that Chris ever went back to the therapist after that conversation. And unfortunately, when I tried to contact the therapist when I got back, she didn't return my calls. And I'm a therapist now, so I get it. It's traumatic, you know? And she had to go through her own process. But those are things that, like, answers that I'll never get, you know? It's like the unknown of the experience. So I was talking to Chris. Do you want me to go through, like...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Share with us as much as you want, Rajani. And again, because I want the audience to know that was not only Chris. You also told us that there were...
Yeah, he was one of nine.
One of nine of the same unit.
Yeah, in 3 months.
In 3 months, all mm-hmm. nine.
Mm-hmm. And then we had a tenth a year later.
This is what I want our audience to get sensitive to, because when we talk about the problems of veteran suicide, mm-hmm. we're talking about 23 to 24 a day.
Yeah.
My husband and I had a conversation with a gentleman. He had a media organization, a huge network of veterans in New Jersey. And he was with us on the phone talking about this. And he said, guys, 24 is what we know of.
Right.
But exactly. There are so many that are not reported, mm-hmm. overdosing on drugs, yeah. or so many other things that are classified different that they're are suicide.
Yeah,
they're
accidents.
Intentional. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So mm-hmm. Tell us what happened with Chris.
So I spoke to him the day that he died, and he was speaking almost incoherently. So I asked him, I said, have you been drinking? And he said, no, I haven't been drinking. And I was like, Chris, well, what's wrong with you? And he was like, I just need you to come home because I'm normal when you're home. And I didn't understand what that meant. I was like, mm-hmm. I don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, before I deployed, we had a conversation, and he was very encouraging of me deploying. Like, he had the same ambition for career progression as I did. So we really kind of egged each other on and, like, doing everything that we could in order to get to the next level of the military. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he was trying to go through selection. And selection is like the process that a soldier would have to go through if they want to be special forces.
Got it.
So special forces is like they're an elite group within the special operations community, right? And so we were already in special operations, and he wanted to be a Green Beret. And so he said that he had gone through selection and he failed the psych eval. I didn't think that he was crazy at the time. So I was like, well, you know, like, what happened? What did you say? What, you know? And he didn't really reveal what happened with that, but it was weighing very heavy on him, you know? Like, what am I going to do in my career? How am I going to move forward? You know, he said that he was going to do it again. And I was okay with that. I encouraged him. Yeah, because I didn't know anything else. I didn't know of anything else that would cause him to fail. I thought, like, maybe something came up in his past, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know. I didn't think it was my business. If it happened before me, it was none of my business. So he was really struggling with that a lot. And I told him, I was like, well, I'm going to be home soon. You know, it's going to be fine. It was month four. I was on a 9-month deployment. So I felt like we're almost halfway there. It's going to be okay. I asked him, you know, like, do you want to go down to Florida and visit my parents? Because he was in North Carolina. You know, do you want to go to Georgia, visit your family? You know, like, there's options. You don't have to stay stuck in North Carolina. And he was like, no, I'm okay. And then we spoke a little bit later. And we had already been married, but we were talking about, like, having a wedding. And so we were planning that. And we wanted to honeymoon in Thailand. And, you know, life seemed to be moving forward in a productive way. and I was happy. I felt okay with that. But that evening when I came back, from my shift and I was talking to him, he was very out of sorts, very emotional, very manic. You know, mm-hmm. I don't have a better word for it.
Mm-hmm.
Talking fast, saying a lot of words, but not really making a lot of sense. I asked him again if he'd been drinking. He said no. He told me that a family member called the cops to do a wellness check on him. And I said, well, why would they do that? And he said, she thought I was going to kill myself. Mm-hmm. I said, are you going to kill yourself? And he responded, this is a hard part for me. He responded, I wasn't. He said, I wasn't going to kill myself. And so, regret, you know? I should have said, but are you now? You know, like, are you thinking about it now? But I didn't know. I just didn't know. So he said, I wasn't. And I said, okay, well, you know, like, tell me what's going on. And he was like, I'm just tired. You know, I'm tired. I think I need to rest. And I was like, okay, well, rest. You know, take a nap. Naps fixed all my problems. So if you're tired, go take a nap. There's nothing else that you have to do. You're going to be okay. You know, just take a nap. And he was like, I think that's a really good idea. I'm just going to rest. And I was like, okay. Well, I told him, I love you. And he said, no matter what you hear, no matter what they say about me, know that I love you, and I love you till my dying day. And I thought, he's so sweet, you know, he's so romantic.
Cause that was a goodbye.
He was, yes, that was absolutely, a goodbye. Absolutely. He was a hopeless romantic, you know? And I thought, like, what a sweet thing to say. And then I went to sleep. It was super late. It was probably like 2 o'clock in the morning, my time. Oh my God, I'm just crying.
It's okay.
Like 2 o'clock in the morning, my time. It was super late and I was tired. I had to wake up for my next shift. And we were supposed to be competing in a CrossFit game that next day. And so I went to sleep, and 2 minutes after I signed off, because we were on Skype, 2 minutes after I signed off, he sent me a message. And he said, am I worth all this pain and heartache? And so I woke up that next morning and I saw the message, and I responded back and I said, of course you are. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. But he never got that message, because an hour after I hung up the phone, he was dead.
When you received those news, Rojani, did you also, I mean, you had to come back to the States.
Yeah.
Immediately to, you know, to assess the situation, going through all the emotions, and then you have to stay here for a little while, or you have to go back right away. What happened?
So I got the notification the next day. That was awful. That was awful. I mean, it's one thing for a person. It's one thing for me to experience pain. It's another thing to feel like I am continuously inflicting pain on other people. And so once I knew, and I had to tell other people, I couldn't escape the fact that every time I told somebody, I was shattering a piece of their world, you know? And so my OIC, or one of the leaders, he came to my door and he was like, and we need to talk to you. I think he was the acting sergeant major at the time. And then I went into another room, and he was my major. He was sitting in front of me, closer than we are, and his lip was shaking, and like his chin was shaking. And I remember in my mind thinking, why is he so sad? I still didn't know, but that is like a very clear image in my mind, you know, like he was he was afraid of what he was about to reveal to me, you know? And his lip was shaking. And he said, "Rajani, Chris is dead." And I said, "What?" And he said, Chris died. I'm so sorry. You know, Chris is dead." And I was like, "I'm okay. I'm okay. It's fine. I'm okay." And he put his hand on my knee and he was like, "Rajani, Chris is dead." And it's like reality, you know, like I was all of a sudden, I think I was experiencing some level of shock because I just kept saying, "I'm okay. Like, I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm okay. You know, it's fine. It's fine. I'm okay." And I asked him, I said, "How?" And they wouldn't tell me. And so then I thought he must have died on his motorcycle. That's what I thought. He rides way too fast. He must have died on his motorcycle. And so I asked and they wouldn't tell me. And I had to call my parents and let my parents know what happened. And it was in the middle of the night for them. And my mom picked up the phone and she was tired and she wasn't processing it, you know. And so I got my dad on the phone and I told him. And I remember when I told my dad, I broke down. Because he heard it, you know, and he repeated it back to me. And it was like, he was like, "What do you mean Chris is dead?" And I heard him say Chris is dead. And it's like for the first time, I understood Chris was dead. And I became very emotional. And I was telling my dad, "They won't tell me what happened. They won't tell me. You know, they're not telling me what happened." And so we had a friend, our neighbor was there, and I guess my parents reached out to them, and they told my parents what happened, and then my parents called me and told me what happened, and I just couldn't believe it. I was shocked.
Then you come back.
Yep.
And you have to go back there again.
I come back. They got me out of Afghanistan that day, which was really, it was an expedient process. They got me out that day. And then I went to Germany, and then I had a layover. So I had to stay in Germany for 24 hours. And I was sitting at a pizza place in Germany. And I was trying to be normal, you know, like just think of normal things. And I was just eating this pizza and I'm sitting at the table and all of a sudden, I couldn't control my tears. The dam broke. There was no more like keeping it together, you know. So my escort walked me back because they wouldn't let me travel alone. She walked me back to the hotel. And I remember I got in the hotel and I put on, I'm a Christian, so I put on worship music. And I just kind of laid before God and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, like, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. I don't know what life is going to look like. But if you get me through this, I promise I'll make it worth it, you know? And so I was so sincere and so desperate. I was so desperate to not feel pain, you know, and this was day one. I had no idea that my life was going to get so much worse before it got better. And I remember the story of David and this is in the Bible, so if you don't read the Bible, then you just bear with me for a second. But I remember the story of David, and David was pleading with God to save his son. Mm-hmm. And his son died anyway. And I remember when David's son died, he got up off the ground and he went back to life and he worshiped the Lord anyway. And he was like, "Okay, well, I'm going to eat and I'm going to shower. And this is the decision that God made." And so I said to myself, I was like, if David could do it with his child, I can do this with my husband, you know? And so that's what that became my mission, is to do that. And I got back to Florida. And I was riding, I rode back on a rotator. I rode back with remains. And so that was really hard. Like, that was a hard experience. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you're in a plane and there's all the flag draped caskets. And I remember thinking, I wish that if Chris had to die, it was like this. You know, I remember feeling like this is something that people would look at and they would be like, this is honorable. You know,
he's a hero.
He's a hero. Yeah. Like, how am I going to protect his honor with this story? Mm-hmm. And so when I was in the plane, I made a promise that I would never lie about how he died. Because if I felt shame about it, then the other people would feel shame about it, or they would feel comfortable maybe in shaming somebody else who might be struggling. So I made that commitment to myself that I wasn't going to lie about it, and that I was going to honor him. Mm-hmm. And I just prepared myself for what was about to come from this, because I felt shielded and protected in Afghanistan. But now the reality of all of the friends and the family and, you know, everybody that was there.
And Chris took his life, and eight other of his same unit friends mm-hmm. did as well within 3 months. Mm-hmm. But then you're left, you're here, mm-hmm. facing all of this devastating news, having to deal with all of, obviously, the situation.
Yes, the aftermath, yeah.
The aftermath of this devastating situation. You don't have the time to work on you because you're right. so busy trying to figure yeah. it out. And this is growing and yeah. growing and growing on you.
And it did. And the hardest part, I think, about being the survivor of a suicide is that there's so much speculation. Why would this person who is so happy and so amazing and so special and so loved, why would he do this? There must be a reason. She must be the reason. And that didn't make it possible. I couldn't grieve because I felt like I had to defend myself. And the military did an investigation. There were accusations that I was having an affair, that I had convinced him to do this, and, you know, I was cleared.
Crazy.
But now, as a therapist, the human mind needs to make sense of situations, right? And sometimes we don't do that in the most productive way. And so I think even then, I was able to operate with some level of grace for other people. I just kind of knew they are doing the best they can with the information that they have. They're trying to make sense
yes.
of what's happened. Also, I need to take a step back because I have no idea what's happening to me, you know? That first week, I lost 12 pounds. I completely stopped eating. I wasn't sleeping. That led to hallucinations. It was awful, about as awful as you can imagine. I mean, it's about as bad as you can imagine, you know? And so I just wanted to be done with it, and I wanted to move as fast as possible. And so let's do the memorial, let's do the funeral, and let's mm-hmm. do it as fast as possible.
So we move on.
Let's move on. I packed up the house almost immediately. Packed up all of his stuff. I knew that I wasn't going to stay in the home. I did not carry the title of widow well. I did not handle that with grace. I had grace for other people. I had much less grace for myself. And so we got through all of that. I mean, there were times during that process where I was like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do a memorial. I don't want to do a funeral. And it wasn't because I was angry at Chris. I actually never experienced anger towards what he did. I always felt like deep sadness. How does somebody feel so alone and simultaneously be so loved? You know, people adored him. He was not by any means a bad soldier or like a problem child. People adored him. He had many, many people that he could call in the middle of the night that would come running to his rescue, that would feel a great sense of honor just to be able to say, I got to help Chris, you know? He was a wonderful human being. And so that conflict always really sat with me. Like, it has to be such a dark place in order for that person, the person that I know, right, that I knew intimately, emotionally, to decide that suicide was the option. You know, and there was alcohol involved. He had acute alcohol intoxication, so he consumed a lot of alcohol in a short amount of time. And so alcohol, I definitely think, was a contributing factor. But I wanted things to move quickly, and so I pushed for things to move quickly. And 29 days after he died, I was back in Afghanistan.
Back to the intensity, back to everything.
It was great. It was great. And I know...
yeah, because it helped you.
Yes, too. Yes. And I'm not smiling at the situation.
No.
But survival is... The need, the desperation to survive, it does funny things with your brain, right? And so I just felt like I need to be back doing something that I'm good at, because I'm not good at this.
So you push your grief, you push the pain, you just encapsulate that, put it in a safe.
Yeah.
Move forward.
And I thought I could. I thought I was doing the right thing, right?
A lot of our veterans report the same.
Yeah.
You know, we're working with the American Legion on this campaign, Be the mm-hmm. One, which is the program from the American Legion to end veteran suicide mm-hmm. and bring awareness. It's what we're doing here. That's exactly what they tell us many times.
Yeah.
They just don't want to deal with this and then put it together in a little compartment. In the back of your mind, in the back of your heart, and trying to move with life, but that never goes away, right, Rajan?
Yeah, no, it doesn't go away, but you don't know that at the time.
Got it.
Right? It's not like you're home thinking about how can I make my situation better so that I don't have to feel. It wasn't a cognitive process. So I wasn't actively engaged in thinking like,
it's just survival.
This is how to fix it. Yes. You go into survival, mm-hmm. right? And I think, you know, one of the things that I teach my clients is the brain does what's familiar, not necessarily what's good for you. The brain is a lazy organ. So it's largely based on things that we've habituated, habits that we've built in our lives mm-hmm. that elicit a certain chemical reaction that bring on an emotion. And when we like that emotion, we want to repeat that behavior, right? So for me, I always got a thrill out of being deployed. I always felt like I was involved in something that was bigger than me and something that had purpose. And being a widow in a unit with people who were whispering and whispering not just in speculation, but whispering like, poor baby, like the pity. I didn't know how to handle that. The constant concern, like, is she going to fly off the deep end? Should she have a weapon? Should she be here? Why is she here? Oh my God, that's Chris's widow. Stop talking. You know, like walking into a room and everyone goes quiet. Like I became the ghost, you know? I wanted to feel alive. I wanted to feel something. And so I wanted to feel something that wasn't associated with the worst moment of my life. And so Afghanistan became that thing. And being on a mission became that thing, and going out there and being productive and showing people, but mostly showing myself, like, man, you're strong. You're a survivor. You're going to get through this. It worked. It worked. And I felt good. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like I was a part of that, but you have to come home.
The quiet moments again. Come back home.
You have to come home.
So how did you move on with your life?
I got married.
Good.
No, it wasn't. Again, it wasn't. It was a maladaptive behavior.
Okay.
I'm still married, you know? Like,
yes.
But looking back, we only learn if we choose to look at things with clear perspective.
Got it.
Right? And so...
True.
You see, and you see this with service members all the time, constantly trying to fill a void with stuff, with things, with people, with substance, right? And so I was trying to fill a void. I did not want to be a widow. The only way to not be a widow is to be married, right? And I had someone who was close to Chris, who knew him, who loved me, and allowed me to grieve openly and not be challenged by that.
Got it.
And so I thought that, man, this is good. Like, I lucked out, you know? I don't have to be a widow anymore. He loves me. I love him. he was actually a widow, or he is a widow. So we had shared experience. We had very similar stories. And it felt good to be seen and not be labeled by that experience. And so we got married a year later. We were married a year almost to the day. And again, that was another maladaptive behavior, me trying to cover the pain that I had. Mm-hmm. So I got married very close to the anniversary of Chris's death because I didn't want to live the rest of my life every time that day came up having to remember. So I thought if I could change the day, I thought that if I could change the day and cover it with something happy, then I wouldn't have to be in pain. And what ended up happening, it was I've spent the last decade in conflict, because what do I celebrate this year? Do I celebrate my wedding anniversary, or do I celebrate or honor the memory of my husband, who I loved very much when he died? You know, I never got the opportunity at the time. I didn't get the opportunity to fall out of love with him. You know, so I was actively in love with somebody that couldn't reciprocate, who wasn't here anymore, and then in a marriage. And it was tumultuous. You know, it was challenging for myself and my spouse. And we did the best that we could, but it was chaos sometimes because we were both mm-hmm. trying to use each other to heal. Mm-hmm. Still avoiding the fact that we were both broken people that needed help. And so, I mean, if you can't tell by now, that is my maladaptive behavior, is I avoid, and I try to deflect, and I try to overcompensate, you know? So like, if I don't want to, at least at the time, I've been working really hard on it, but if I don't want to deal with it, then the best way is to do the exact opposite, you know? So like, if I'm feeling sad, the best way to move forward is to just be happy for people. And that starts to take a toll on you as well, because then you start to feel like you're constantly faking. Nobody knows you. There is no vulnerability. There is no intimacy. There is no transparency, right? You're always in a facade, and you're trying to mold yourself into who you think people want to see.
So when did you feel like, okay, all of this is happening to me, I identify these behaviors, mm-hmm. I really didn't heal that pain. When did you decide to be part of the solution and help others to go through? Because you still were going to deployments, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So I, shortly after I got back from my last deployment, I started doing suicide interventions. So there's this program called Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training. And so I became a trainer for that program. It's through Living Works. It's, if you have an opportunity, it's an excellent program. I'm not sponsored, but I really do value it. And so I started to do that, and it exposed me to the pervasiveness of suicidal ideation within the military, just how many people are genuinely struggling with thoughts of suicide. I had no idea, because I had never had those thoughts. It was such a foreign concept to me that people actually live like this every single day. And then somewhere along the journey, I felt like I could help people the way that I'd been helped. And that was important to me, to turn my pain into purpose. And that's what started to motivate me. So I attribute like the passion that I have for what I do now to the experience that I had with Chris, not just his death, but also his life, to see the dichotomy of one individual and how different they can look at any given time. We all need somebody. We all need someone to see us for exactly who we are, right? And then learn how to reach out and ask for help. So when I got out of the military in 2018, I'd started therapy before that, and then I started doing therapy more intensely when I got out. I went back to school, and I became a clinical social worker, and I've been doing it ever since.
Thank you very much for listening. And if you like the information that we shared with you today, please subscribe to the Express Soul Health and Wellness podcast and follow us in the social media outlets of your choice. Until next time, please remember, health is wealth for the body, mind, and soul.